Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. Selma Weiss and Howard Braun will be interviewing Leib Kessler. It's January 31st, 1995. Okay, we'll continue where we left off. This is tape two. When you were talking about the beginning of your days at Penn State College.
Well, it occurs to me that one of the problems of this fund, let's see, I graduated, no, till June 40 to October 43. I may have brushed over a lot of the Depression years, which were very formative for the Jewish community as a whole, not only for me, particularly the McKeesport Jewish community. As I said, we had so many involvements around synagogue membership and education, but one of the things that was very formative was we had two organizations for young people. One was called the AZA, Aleph Tzaddik Aleph. And that was, you had to be 16 to join that. I don't even remember at this late date what its ultimate purpose was. I think it was a junior division of the Negris. That's my recollection. And it was a national organization. And that was one sort of involvement that most Jewish youth had. And we also had a Boy Scout troop that was just for Jews. We discussed, I think, or you asked me on the last interview about the involvement and anti-Semitism and how it might have affected us. Certainly one of the possibilities was, why did we have a Jewish troop as opposed to a general membership? And it probably was very obvious at that time that there was separation in all things for young Jews. However, it wasn't until probably I personally was not aware of this kind of prejudice. I might have been, but wasn't really. I don't have any conscious recollection of that. Until then, I went away to college, and we just accepted a form of segregation as Jews. There were four Jewish fraternities. Non-Jewish fraternities did not in any way make an attempt to acquire Jewish members. That was an accepted way of life, an accepted fact of life. It didn't seem to me to be any form of prejudice. It was just the way things were. At least as young people being brought up in that kind of an environment, you accepted that you were Jewish and that everybody around you was Jewish, and the Gentile world was separate, and that was the way it was. However, in college, as I said, I joined the Phi Epsilon Pi fraternity, all Jewish members. It was everything. It was where the way we lived, and it was our social life, and it was academic life. All
to live at the
fraternity house, and the organization of the fraternity was pretty much within its own power. The young people organized it, ran it, including such things as budgeting for meals, hiring and firing the cook, the waiters, the household help. It's an interesting fact when I look back on it, how much responsibility and authority was actually given to the young people. This authority became more and more transferred to the older groups rather than the younger groups. The first level, the freshmen were of course, considered the plebes and weren't given any responsibility. But after that, it gradually increased, and until the last year, when a senior would be elected the president, and he was in fact responsible for everything that went on in the House. Now, there were advisors. We had a couple of advisors, one who lived in State College, a man by the name of Charles Sklow, and we had a couple of off-campus advisors who used to come and visit once in a while. One was the famous Harold V. Cohn, who was a Post-Gazette writer in Pittsburgh, theater writer and movie critic. He would come up once a year, and as a matter of fact, we had he would come with the Epstein brothers, who were famous movie moguls at that time. I think they were producers and directors and screenwriters, all sorts of things. But these are the kinds of affiliations and attachments one had being Jewish and being involved in Jewish activities. The general attitude was to encourage young men to be good in their studies and also to be active in campus activities. I was extremely active. My activities first centered around the Hillel Foundation, which was the center of Jewish activities. The Hillel Foundation, now I understand common all over colleges, was not so common then, but it provided services on Friday night. It provided holiday services for those who were forced to remain at school for one reason or another during the Jewish holidays. More important, I think, was the fact that the Hillel Foundation actually was my first input into leadership as a Jew in the fundraising activity. We had a United Jewish Appeal Drive at State College. The first was in 1941. And that year, the students raised somewhere in the neighborhood of $1,500, which was, I was the chairman. The question comes up, why was I the chairman? I was the chairman because prior to going to State College, I had worked in the United Jewish Appeal Office in Pittsburgh as a volunteer because my mother was the office manager of the United Jewish Appeal, which was then called the UJ, United Jewish Federation, and United Jewish Fund. There were two separate organizations, two separate boards. However, one office. And my mother had the office managerial responsibility. And so I had some direct input into from her, and also from the then executive director, is a man by the name of Maurice Taylor, who was a brilliant Jewish leader. And he hired a man to run the United Jewish Fund Drive by the name of Arthur Rosensham. Arthur Rosensham was probably one of the finest men I have ever met in Jewish affairs. He was knowledgeable, likable, worked day and night, never tired, had great enthusiasm for his work, and generally developed what we now recognize as the United Jewish Fund of Pittsburgh. In my judgment, he was more responsible than any other single person. But it was these influences that led to my then in State College being involved with Hillel. And then I was asked by the rabbi, whose name I don't recall, if I would be the chairman of the first drive. Now, interestingly, there were some Jews who lived in State College, one of whom I mentioned, Charles Sklow. They had a store there, and a few others, but they did not have any sort of organization, Jewish central organization, because they had no synagogue. Most of the Jewish professors and storekeepers either came came from Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Altoona and had their affiliations in those places. So Hillel was mainly a student activity. There were some adults, but mainly students. And therefore, the first United Jewish Fund Drive in State College was directed towards students. We did attempt to collect money from some of the adults. I don't know how successful we were. The United Jewish Fund in itself as a central organization just started in 1939. So this was only 2 years later. And it wasn't a national organization covering all bases by any means. I just would point out that my fraternity, which was Phi Epsilon Pi, was probably the most generous of the groups of all the Jewish fraternities. I had as an assistant the man who became president of the Jewish Federation of Pittsburgh in later years, Jesse Cohn. And I remember that Jesse Cohn donated $10. And that was the largest single gift that we had at that time. He hasn't changed much. He's still doing that. Nonetheless, it was a wonderful experience and fruitful, and I think we did it the second year as well. After that, I didn't, because I got involved in all sorts of other activities. I became very active in campus affairs, and I was elected to head what's called the tribunal, which actually set the rules of behavior for the campus, for the students of the campus. And I became president of the fraternity house, and I became manager of the lacrosse team, and was active in interfraternity affairs, and was the interfraternity ball, annual ball chairman. And so there were many things going on. In addition, I was trying to pass and get decent grades so I could get into medical school. The majority of people who went to Penn State were either from, as I said, Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, and a lot of small towns in between. There were about 10% of the campus population came from New York and New Jersey. So it was an opportunity, my first opportunity, to meet people from other walks of life, people from other parts of the country. The first broadening experience outside of this area, outside of living in the Keysport. The fraternity in itself was an experience in responsibility, management, and was a great training experience for most of us, and particularly those of us in a leadership capacity. Schoolwork, as far as I was concerned, was never a big problem. I'm never a straight A student, but certainly always had B pluses and so forth, but A minuses, but did all right. But then came the subject of getting into medical school. In the meantime, the war broke out. The war, actually, Pearl Harbor was the end of the year 1941. That is just at the beginning of 1942, and I remember that so clearly because we were all on campus. The news came, Roosevelt made his speech about the outbreak of the war, and to young men in college at that time, nobody, none of us, thought about the seriousness of war. We all thought it was a great, glamorous event, and everybody was very excited about the prospect, not realizing what it really meant. War, however, brought changes in our college life, and gradually we began to understand some of the changes. The campus was changed over to a military operation. Most of the students on campus were in uniform, and their education was being paid for by the United States Army. With that came along the rationing, and you couldn't buy the food that you wanted to buy. You couldn't travel as much because you the parents who would ordinarily drive to pick you up for holidays or that sort of thing couldn't use rubber that freely. Rubber was a great rarity. New tires, that is. Tires were made of rubber.
Gasoline.
Gasoline, too, was scarce. So things changed in that sense, and the students now were not people who got to know one another, that practically everybody was new, there was the campus life changed, there was not that rah-rah party activity that the college campuses had meant up until that point. It became a very strict, studious environment, and we, as a matter of fact, had to give up our fraternity house. We had to lease our fraternity house to the Army so they could house soldiers, and we had to find other places to live. Gradually, those of us who had moved out of the fraternity house, well, this, I guess, took about a year, so this took us to the end of 1942, and by 43, many of the men in the fraternity house, really boys, had been drafted and gone into the service or had volunteered in various phases. But I was deferred because I was a pre-med student. And all pre-med students remained on campus in their previous position, did not enter the military service in any form. The question, of course, was getting into medical school. And at that time, if I recall, in order to get into medical school, the odds were about 1 in 10. In other words, for every 10 applicants, one got accepted. For Jews, it was much worse than that. This was my first real experience with the burden of Judaism, of Jewishness. And that was that, for instance, at the University of Pittsburgh, there were 85 members of a class every year. That was the standard allocation of students for School of Medicine. Now, they took each year 10% Jews. Now, they couldn't tear us in half, so one year they would take 9 Jewish students, and the next year they would take 8 Jewish students, and thereby managed to maintain what was called the numerus clausus. And this was a very strict routine, and was reduplicated year in and year out, and it seemed that nobody did much about it. Nobody said much about it. Again, like Jewish fraternities, like all of the things that I've discussed, it was an accepted way of life.
Was that typical at most of the medical schools?
It was typical of all medical schools. It was a standard approach to the what was called the numerus clausus. And as a matter of fact, 10% was pretty good, because that was really better than, and there were other groups. I don't want to discuss that other, the other group, but there are other groups that didn't get as many as their actual numbers permitted. Jews actually got slightly more than the numbers. Yeah, because we had, well, I think that our relationship to the population in 1940 was slightly higher than it is today. I think it was 5%.
Yeah.
And it's not as high now. But at any rate, I got into medical school not because I was such a brilliant student. I remember going to the dean for an interview. It was Dean McElroy. I didn't even apply anywhere else because I wanted to be at home. I applied. I had an interview. The interview went very satisfactorily, but I was told I had to wait for an opening because of the numerus clausus. Nobody made any bones about that. Because of that so-called numerus clausus, because there were so many Jewish boys allowed, the Jewish community, surprisingly, had a lot to say about who those boys were. What I mean by the Jewish community, leaders of the Jewish community, and some of those leaders knew me because of my mother's contact working for the United Jewish Fund, and also because of my contacts and working with, in a volunteer capacity. And Charlie Rosenblum, who was then one of the major Jewish leaders of the community, and later in life a very close friend of mine, actually wrote to and actually called Dean McElroy, urging that he accept me as a student. And I was accepted not the year that I applied, but the following year. So then I started medical school. I graduated from college in 1943, October 43. We didn't have, that was one time when we didn't have summer vacations. Because of the war, colleges went around the calendar so that the year ended in October instead of the following May, the graduation year. For that class. My class was supposed to graduate in May of 44, and actually we graduated in October of 43. And I therefore had to wait for the class of 44 to start medical school. Well, I did something that was typical of brash youth. I joined the Navy. I needn't say that my mother, who was a widow and working hard and full responsibility for me. I took that very hard and went around to various people in influential positions managing to try to get me sent to medical school, because the Army was then sending people to medical school and the Navy. She was assured by our congressman then, who was Sam Weiss from Glassport, Pennsylvania. Sam Weiss had been a friend of my father's as youngsters. They grew up together in McKeesport and Glassport, and he was in Washington at the time, and he assured my mother that there was no issue, that all medical schools were recognizing, all the Army and the Navy rather, recognized only those students on a first priority basis who had already been accepted as I had been, and that therefore the Navy would be obligated to send me back to medical school when my class started. But at least I had a year of enlisted man's experience in the Navy, which I found very interesting, and I always look back on that favorably. I went through boot camp, something I might not have otherwise have done. As a matter of fact, just a little aside, I remember I was sent to a boot camp called Great Lakes, north of Chicago. I remember that was one of the coldest experiences I've ever had in my life, even though I was young and vigorous. We had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and march to the gunnery range, which was on the lake, and that was a couple of miles from our barracks. I never forget how cold that was. And then we had friends in Chicago. I had friends in Chicago and another fellow who was stationed at Great Lakes. And we went into Chicago. And I, to this day, can't ever understand why people live in Chicago. I'll never forget how cold I was.
It happened to be 63 and 4 were exceptionally cold years in the Midwest.
It was terrible.
It was terrible.
At any rate, you know, we wore those what was called pea jackets. I guess they weren't all that warm anyhow.
They were.
Yeah. And sailor's caps, so, you know, we were quite exposed. But at any rate, it was a worthwhile experience. Having to do with the Jewish question, again, it was interesting that I was the only one in my company a company consists of about 150 men. I was the only one in my company who had graduated from college. This was, as I said, I graduated October 43, so this was in probably November, December of 43. By that time, most of the draftees were older men, and most of the draftees were men from the hinterlands of the countries. Mm. And my company in particular was mostly Tennessee, Appalachia hillbillies. So my first assignment, even when I was in boot camp, was teaching the English language to these men. How to sign their name was the first thing they had to learn. It was a shocking experience to me, but also an enlightening one to realize how backward we were, how backward our country was. It was, by the way, the first time I ever heard music, which I abhorred then and still abhor, called country. I had never heard it prior to that, but there was, of course, entertainment on weekends, Saturday night there was a big entertainment extravaganza. There were the men were entertained by visiting artists, and the artists were people from the hill country who played guitar and did those things that I was totally unfamiliar with, had never heard, thought was terrible, and of course, would become one of the big sellers in the music industry. The experience as a Jew was that I was the only Jew in my company. I guess most Jews didn't go in the service as enlisted men. There were many, I'm sure, who did, but not that late. Most of them had been gone, or by that time were fathers with children and therefore didn't go, or were over 38. Those were some of the limiting factors. But I remember that I was standing guard duty, and I heard somebody say on the second deck, as they called it, second story, it's bad enough being a damn Yankee, but being a Yankee Jew is worse. Well, I challenged him to a fight. And he, of course, to my great relief, backed down and apologized. But this was a constant problem in my years in the service, not only as an enlisted man, but later as an officer, realizing that there was this kind of anti-Semitic use of language, oft times reflecting inner thoughts, never being meant directly in that way, but reflecting, as I say, attitudes. So it was an experience, another opportunity to learn about what our world was all about, not realizing then what we were soon to learn about what was going on in Europe. But because I had been accepted in medical school, the medical schools at that time were given the right to bring their own students back to their classes, the rule being that if they could not find the student who they had accepted, then the army would fill that space with a choice of their own from one of their educational programs. Fortunately, I was not hard to find. My mother made sure of that. And I was given orders. I was then stationed at an air base in Maryland called Patuxent River, fortunately. The assignment from boot camps were interesting because long sheafs of names were sent out, and where one group of names left off, another group started. Did you have this experience at all? And as those names you would read down, and there would be one group would say, San Francisco, FFT. You know what that meant? San Francisco for further transfer. Yeah. That was for the Pacific, and you're on your way to the Pacific somewhere. And mine, the group before me went San Francisco, FFT, and then mine was Patuxent River, Maryland. And I remember excitedly we said, where's Patuxent River? Where's Patuxent? Who ever heard of Patuxent River? Oh, the excitement of that. But anyway, Patuxent River was just 50 miles out of Washington, D.C., and again, turned out to be a very rewarding experience. I spent a lot of time in Washington and in a hospital in an air base in Maryland, and then after 1 year at that base was given orders to return to medical school. And I'll never forget my one experience that always sort of stands out in my mind because it really is a lesson of privilege.
when my orders came in, I was a pharmacist made third class. By the way, you became a pharmacist made third class not because of anything you knew, but because you had a college degree, period. Anybody with a college degree became a pharmacist made third class. They needed lots of pharmacists made.
Right, I'm going to stop you there.